under the bonnet, technical considerations in running Open University Podcasting. I think so far today we've largely had an interesting mix of presentations, but one of the things that struck me is that most of the questions and examples we've heard so far are people probably operating largely on their own or in very small groups, looking at maybe a departmental solution or just individually. One of the focuses of Steeple, and one of the things that drew Oxford, Cambridge and ourselves together, was actually the problem of doing podcasting at institutional level. In other words, how can you leverage the scale of institutions to actually make it easier to do podcasting? One of the people earlier on pointed out that the focus for people doing podcasting should be on the content. It shouldn't be actually on how do I go about making this. It shouldn't even be on craft skills about how do I use a video camera, how do I use audio, how do I use a microphone. It should be really focusing on the content, and I believe that an institutional solutions should focus on providing the tools and the frameworks for lecturers, academics, students, to actually focus really on the content. So one of the things I'm just going to talk about here really is the technical considerations that you might need to think about if you are approaching this institutionally. So if you're an institution who doesn't already have a nice system like Marcus has, for example, what would you need to consider if you do that? The laptop wants to wake up. Okay, so I've got 6 points on here, which I believe cover most of the areas that you need to think about institutionally. These are technical. This doesn't cover all the legal things that Peter talked about earlier. It doesn't cover rights. It doesn't cover issues like engagement with all the departments, all the people, which is quite a major thing. So let me just run through these. We've got media authoring and capturing systems. We've heard about Marcus's automated lecture capturing. But really, at the end of the day, for podcasting, you just need audio and video files. That's it. Maybe some slides to go with it, maybe some nice pretty pictures. You just need something out from that. But you're going to have a vast array of media authoring systems, and that's going to really depend on what is the focus of your institutional podcasting service. Is it going to be on lecture capturing? Is that what the institution wants? Do they want to capture lectures? Is it going to be such as the Open University, where we largely have content that's made through a production process, more akin to television? Or is it going to be students going out, like Warwick was suggesting, actually interviewing people? All of those will drive your media authoring and capturing systems. And so you need to think about those, and that will then drive your technical considerations on those. Content management system. I've separated this out from web portals and delivery service because you can, in actual fact, potentially leverage existing content management systems. Maybe your university has a VLE. Maybe you want to use that as your content management system. May not be suitable if you're offering material to the public domain, mind you. You may, for instance, have a repository system. The Open University has invested in eDocumentum, for example. You may wish to leverage that with various workflows and make that your content management system. Or you may want to do something bespokely, and I'll mention what we've actually done for our podcast service. Number three on my list is media transcoding. I think Peter alluded to the fact that in actual fact he basically made it the job of Oxford's departments to deliver the content in the right format. I'm not sure if I got that quite right. I actually believe that people should be able to deliver their audio and video files in whatever format is convenient for them. And that institutionally, that's an institutional problem, which is easily solvable. There are many technologies out there that can actually transcode that into the appropriate formats for podcasting. Or we've just heard about mobile devices, you maybe want to deliver it in mobile-friendly formats. So media transcoding service is another very important element. Delivery service. As I said, I've separated this out from content management because I believe you need to think about your delivery service. if you're planning to deliver large quantities of data as a part of a public iTunes proposition, for example, you need to think about that delivery service. And it may not be linked, might not be the same, rather, as your content management system. It may be stored somewhere else. I'll come back on more in a moment. Logging and statistics. I personally think this is vital. Again, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment. You need to think about this because if you're going to measure, we've already had people asking, well, you know, how do you know your students are actually listening to those? And personally, I don't have a solution for that. But, you know, people want to know how much you're downloading. Your stakeholders institutionally are going to ask you, well, how successful have we been? I was actually asked, what does a download mean? You may want to go away and think about that. How does that equate to web hits? What does a download mean? Peter Scott said, we tend to break at the Open University our content into small video segments. So does a single download of a 3-minute video, is that the same as a single download of an hour and a half lecture? I don't have an answer for you. But I believe statistics is an important thing to capture, one of the things you need to technically consider. Web portal. I actually think this is optional, although I know there's several people here who've already talked to me about the fact that they want to build a web portal for their podcast. It isn't essential. In actual fact, it's the whole point about RSS feeds and podcasting is that people can subscribe to them, and that means also web servers can subscribe to them. I put a picture here, which actually has appeared in someone else's slide already, and I honestly tried to get UCL in that picture. I do apologize because they're also on that site, but I refreshed this God knows how many times last night, and I couldn't get all four institutions on there. But Bjorn has put together this little experimental portal, which essentially aggregates the content from our four institutional podcast services. And in a sense, why do you need your own portal? But that may be needed because that's actually one of the institution's objectives as part of providing a service. Again, I'm focusing on institutional issues here. Right, I'm just going to go through some of those in a little bit of detail and allude a little bit to what we've done at the Open University. Peter's already shown you, I wasn't quite expecting that, part of our interface. We've built our own content management system. We actually started work on it about 18 months ago, although I'd been thinking about it for probably more than 2 years now. Essentially, it's just simply based on a PHP MySQL. It doesn't use any previous frameworks. It's built completely from scratch. It's based on our own experiences of doing content management systems for webcasting. Has a very simple administration. That's geared towards podcast authoring by staff. I'd actually like to extend to students, but there's all sorts of policy issues that need to be crossed. And it's geared towards iTunes U management. I quickly found that when we got involved in the iTunes project that there was a lot more involvement in terms of tracking data, in terms of the production process, than you'd want to expose to normal staff who just want to put a podcast up. I had a very simple concept, which was that basically people should just be able to upload a file, doesn't matter what format it is, add some metadata around it, you've got a podcast. Is it really that difficult? And in fact, the difficult bit is actually thinking about the content, as I said at the beginning. The system provides media transcoding. We use the Episode Engine solution principally for any staff members to upload content. But we do also use Podcast Producer for our iTunes material. Podcast Producer has a great workflow management. It allows us to produce multiple formats. So, for example, the audio-visual files that we put in iTunes, we actually generate 8 different formats. We don't actually use them all at the moment in iTunes. But we do, for instance, generate 3GP files. So in theory, we could actually, if we needed to deliver it over mobile network, we've got the files there ready. Two other objectives when I built this or designed this system was the podcast should be intranet restricted, so that people can restrict it just to your intranet. given the time, I won't go too much on that. And also that they can be unlisted and private. We found that a lot of people just wanted to experiment. They don't want to experiment in the public domain, but they, in other words, so anyone can see, but they may want to offer it out to people outside your intranet. So we have unlisted capability. Okay, third thing on my original list was the media transcoding service. I presume most people in here probably understand what I mean by this, but the key thing when you're looking at a media transcoding service is not something that just sits on one person's desktop. Well, it might be actually. Maybe you send it to Carl Marshall up the back there. He processes the file for you and spits it out and sends it back in an email, which wouldn't be the best idea. What you really need is a scalable encoding solution. And there are, as I've got a list at the bottom there, a number of commercial solutions out there. They're not cheap, although you could argue Apple Podcaster comes sort of free with the server solution. And I'm sure that there are open source solutions out there as well. I just didn't take the time to look for some. But basically, these are all industrial strength solutions. I believe Carbon Coder is used by BBC these days. Flip Factory is largely targeted at media organizations, but we're looking at it to use with eDocumentum, for example. And Episode Engine, I've already mentioned. Episode Engine also do a plugin for Podcast Producer, which allows it to accept more formats than the default. So, scalable, what do I mean by that? You can have lots of computers working at it. So if you find that you decide to go down the lecture capture route, what you might suddenly find is that you're recording maybe, I don't know, 20 lectures a day, audiovisual lectures, and someone can do the maths on the amount of terabytes of data you're going to suddenly find you're generating. You've got to convert all that. And don't forget, you have to get it all done before the beginning of the next day's lectures, or otherwise you're going to be constantly behind unless you can catch up on the weekends. So you need something that's scalable where you can just add more servers, assuming you've got the money and resources. High level of automation, so it can link into, it largely operates on its own. You don't have people running around having to keep fixing things or move things from left to right. You can get integrated workflows. Obviously, there's no point just having this thing sitting on its own. It's got to be able to link into whatever solutions you build as an institution. Now, I'm not too sure about how Marcus has pulled all his system together, but inevitably you'll probably find that it's not easy to actually go and buy something like this off the shelf. Opencast, the Matterhorn project, other projects that exist, they're all trying to do that for institutions, but they're not there quite yet. And there's a lot of expertise that's potentially needed in deploying them. So you may well have to customize your media transcoding service to fit into your existing systems. Scalable file storage, I think that's fairly obvious, but if you start generating large quantities of files, you've got to have some way of increasing your file storage. And I've mentioned the scalable solutions. Delivery service, I just want to, as I said earlier, I want to separate that out from your content management system because there's a couple of important considerations. Obviously, it needs to deliver RSS and whatever media you have. Bandwidth. We heard Marcus mention they had complaints about bandwidth being used through the institution. Basically, I had a pretty good idea that we might blow away the university's bandwidth when we launched iTunes U. And we actually talked about having ways of profiling that, making sure that we didn't interrupt the university's normal business operations, which in many ways are more crucial than a single launch. So you're going to need to think about that and decide how you might control that. I'm sure your IT departments would be very impressed if you came along and talked to them about wanting to control your traffic in advance of actually breaking their connections. If you're using web servers, which you almost certainly will, one thing you'll need to consider for those more technically minded in here is the fact that most websites, the files are delivered very quickly. They don't take very long. On the other hand, if you're downloading a 1 hour lecture in video format, it might actually take for some users an hour. A default Apache installation only allows 250 simultaneous connections. Maybe sufficient for your needs. But if you need more, you're going to need some customization. And that often means not just customizing the server and software, you need to actually probably adapt your hardware to meet that. Consider using off-site content delivery services such as Amazon S3. Peter Scott mentioned this earlier. We decided to bypass the whole bandwidth problem at the university. And we actually, at the Open University, have all our iTunes U content located on Amazon S3. Peter mentioned he's basically using his credit card to actually pay for that at the moment. That's not his personal one. That's the university-provided one. It costs us probably, on average, under $1,000 a month. So why not use it? No. It's not that difficult to set up. We basically use redirects from our own web servers. So when we get a request, hits our own web servers. If it's an off-site IP, we redirect it to Amazon S3. It delivers the content. If it's internal, it comes straight off our servers. Basically, we use so little bandwidth that our ACS services don't even notice us, except for occasionally when one makes a mistake and doesn't get the redirects in there. it happened. Lastly, you might consider using a content delivery network. This is probably a bit of an expensive option, but I raise this particularly for any people who are involved with Janet or maybe JISC here, is that I have heard discussions in the past, mainly actually do with web streaming, webcasting, not podcasting, about Janet potentially providing services on behalf of the higher education for content delivery networking. So that may be something to think about if you really are serious about that. Okay, I am getting near the end. Glad to know for those people who are hungry. Logging and stats. I've been very keen on this, and actually I can thank John Hickey for setting me in the direction on making sure you get all the stats. That's a first point. They're determining the objectives of the podcast service, and that's going to be an institutional decision. Is it that you just want to be the top dog in iTunes? You know, you want to be on the top there. Well, how do you measure that besides obviously looking on the iTunes application? How many things are actually going to be there? That may not be your objective, though. Your objective may be we want to provide a service to our students, in which case, if you are going to be measuring downloads, you may want to know which students. You need to be able to log that information. So as I said, what information you attempt to log should support whatever your objectives are, at the very least. A couple of other points I want to mention here is, because the things are going to be gotchas. One is, anyone who's actually handwritten an RSS file will know that you have to actually, as part of the RSS standard, include a web URL in it. Now, maybe people use dummy URLs, but those URLs ideally should go to something real and of value and of relation to the podcast. Problem is that if that link is clinked from within something like iTunes or some other podcast application, what it tends to do is it fires up someone's web browser, goes and connects to the site. That's great. When you go and look at your stat logs, there's no referrer. There's nothing telling you where the hell that came from. And if you only put in your top-level site for the university or whatever, you'll never know that particular viewer actually came via that podcast. So consider adding some form of tracking links. We use a system at the Open University, which doesn't cover all our websites, but basically I liaise with the people who run that, and we create tracking links for all our podcasts that are at least done for iTunes U. And that allows us to provide some sort of ability to analyze what people are coming in from these sites, from these podcasts. Lastly, two points I've got there just quickly. I was going to show you a couple more stats that Peter didn't show. If you decide to have a complicated setup, such as, for instance, we have Amazon S3, we also have our own web logs, and we also have iTunes U logs that we have to analyze, that can be quite complicated to automate. So before you decide to have a complicated arrangement of things, think about how you might analyze the logs. In your mad rush to set up for iTunes, as at least several people in here who've been through the experience will know, you can easily forget about all this stuff. And I'll tell you, I've scratched probably as much hair as Peter's lost, I think, over the last year, trying to work out how to consolidate logs and understand, well, why is this log showing more than these ones? last point on there is third-party channels such as iTunes, without even asking you, actually deliver your content through their own content delivery networks. Problem is, it doesn't hit your network. So you'll never know about it unless you actually think about how you might track that, either by talking with those channel partners and understanding what's going on. So I discovered that we actually had, this was shortly after Christmas, we had an additional 300,000 hits that I hadn't realized we'd had back in October and November. Of course, I added them to our charts because it sounded like a good idea. Anyway, that's basically a few places you might like to go and see. I see lots of people getting their cameras out. I just have two more slides I just want to highlight for those people before we go to lunch, which is on bandwidth. Peter nicked some of my slides and showed earlier, so I left these ones in just because he hadn't shown them. This is our hourly network traffic for last September. Basically, I thought this was interesting because it shows that it does vary during the course of the day. This is for iTunes U. We tend to get a dip in the morning, and the peaks tend to be late in the evening, which actually isn't because of UK traffic, it's because of United States traffic largely. This doesn't look too bad. I mean, I don't know what most institutions' pipes are like to the internet, but the Open University has a little over 200 megabyte connection in total, 20 megabits per second. It's not bad. It's not going to hurt our business if we were to deliver it normally. However, this is what happened in the beginning of July. Over a very short period of time, we actually went over 300 megabits per second. The university would not be able to deliver that. We were only able to do that because Amazon S3 was able to scale. In actual fact, the servers we currently use wouldn't have been able to deliver this because we wouldn't have been able to scale up. If we actually had to put in the servers to do this, it would cost us quite a lot of money, certainly far more than $1,000 a month, which is what it currently costs us. Anyway, there you go. Thank you very much for your time and attention.